Good evening, Labor Day and tip workers, the struggle to survive, protests sweep America. What's next? Drugs and excuses for police violence, and 50 years since a U.S.-sponsored coup in Chile. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI News for Friday, September 4th, 2020. In one of the last major economic reports before Election Day, unemployment in the United States dropped sharply in August from 10.2% to a still high 8.4%, with about half the 22 million jobs lost to the coronavirus outbreak recovered so far, while an increasing number of Americans reported that their jobs were gone for good. Donald Trump exulted over the latest unemployment figure, saying that is many, many months ahead of schedule. Democratic nominee Joe Biden downplayed the report and said the viral outbreak is still weighing on the economy. Retailers added 250,000 jobs, led by big gains at warehouse clubs and supercenters and restaurants, hotels, and entertainment firms, which gained 174,000 jobs. Among the workers left out are jobs that rely on tips for most of their income. Many already made too little to get unemployment insurance. As the Labor Day weekend begins, many restaurant workers are increasing their organizing and their demands for ending the tipped minimum wage. Peabody Award-winning director Abby Ginsberg just released the film Waging Change about the challenges facing tip workers. Here's an excerpt.
In the United States, we have a two-tiered wage system. There is a federal minimum wage, currently $7.25, but tipped workers are allowed to be paid a sub-minimum wage of $2.13 an hour. As long as tips bring them to the full minimum wage.
The forces of the status quo are very powerful. They're institutionalized. We have the National Restaurant Association. We even have people here in the Congress who don't believe there should be any minimum wage.
It is no surprise that the $2.13 an hour has been stuck there since 1991.
There was a deal brokered between Congress and the National Restaurant Association to say, okay, we'll let you increase the regular minimum wage, but we want the subminimum wage frozen permanently at $2.13 an hour.
When you reveal to people that tipped workers make as little as $2.13 an hour, most people are shocked by that. And to think that you could be making $2 and have to rely on $5 an hour worth of tips to make just $7 is a scary thing. So this is as just and important a struggle as there is right now.
There are 17 states that are at the absolute bottom of the barrel with a sub-minimum wage for tipped workers at $2.13 an hour. Another 26 states set their tipped wage rates above $2.13 an hour, but below their regular state minimum wage. But seven states, California, Nevada, Oregon, Washington, Montana, Minnesota, and Alaska, require the restaurant industry to pay the full minimum wage plus tips.
Excerpts from the film Waging Change on the situation facing tip workers. The film's director, Abby Ginsberg, spoke with WBAI earlier today.
The pandemic has been a disaster for tipped workers, and here's why. If you work in a 213 state, or, you know, New York is a little bit higher, so if you take Massachusetts where it's $4.95, instead of $12, the employer generally only reports the amount that they pay you. So many, many, many restaurant workers are making below the threshold that is necessary to get unemployment during the pandemic, even though they're unemployed. So it's a double whammy for these workers. They're screwed initially because they're not making enough money to even pay their bills. And then they're screwed again because now that we're in a pandemic and all restaurants were closed, they don't make enough to qualify for the state unemployment floor. The group One Fair Wage has done a major fundraising campaign and has raised an enormous amount of money, but it's not enough. They've raised over $20 million and they have had over 150,000 applicants. That comes out to a pittance under $500 a person if everybody who applied got money, and not everybody who applied did get money.
How are they raising this money?
They raised it from individuals and foundations. Part of the reason people were so generous is because they really understood that this was a group of workers who had nowhere to turn but to food banks. They literally could not get state unemployment. their jobs went away because of the pandemic, and they were desperate. One Fair Wage is the main organizing group that deals with restaurant workers. They were able to do this incredibly successful fundraising campaign. But when you figure out how much each worker gets paid, it is a pittance and not enough. The long food bank lines are often made up of restaurant workers who are now desperate to feed their families.
The PPE stimulus, what about that?
The problem with PPE was that you had to keep people employed with an eye towards the fact that you would reopen, and you would have, so you've got them through March and April, and then in May, when you reopened, they'd go back to work. The problem with that is the degree of reopening has been so little. In California, restaurants are still largely closed. Often it was the bigger restaurant chains that got it, not the small mom and pop stores that couldn't even figure out how to apply for it because maybe they speak a different language other than English as their primary language. They didn't have somebody to help them. The bank was dealing with their big claims, not the little claims. There were a lot of reasons why PPE did not reach the small people, and that would include small family-owned restaurants.
What should be the priorities right now?
There's a big priority for New York. Governor Cuomo actually raised the tip minimum wage for everybody but restaurant workers in New York. It is time for him to do that for restaurant workers as well. He was under pressure, obviously, from the restaurant lobby, the National Restaurant Association, and when he raised the tip minimum wage to a regular wage for everybody, he left off the restaurant workers. So one thing people can do is to write to the governor and say, please include restaurant workers in this. They need to be able to make a living wage as well. That's one thing. The other thing, if anybody's listening and wants to donate, the donation group for One Fair Wage, it's called OFW for One Fair Wage, emergencyfund.org. And lastly, I would urge people to watch my film called Waging Change, which is available for the next week on Women Make Movies, WMM.com. And this sort of lays out the situation across the country with issues of how do we get from a tip minimum wage to a living wage.
Director Abby Ginsberg, roughly 29 million Americans are receiving state unemployment benefits but are no longer drawing an extra $600 a week in federal jobless aid, which expired more than a month ago. The Trump administration has set up a program to provide some of the unemployed with $300 a week, but the new rules make many ineligible. Meanwhile, restaurants in New York City filed a $2 billion class action lawsuit against city and state officials on Thursday, alleging the indoor dining ban caused irreparable harm to the city's food and beverage industry and pushing for the return to indoor dining. On Monday, both Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio acknowledged the pressure that the New York City restaurants are facing, but neither have said when or under what circumstances indoor dining in the city could resume. De Blasio said Monday that restaurants in the city deserve a timeline and hopes a plan will be set in September, but admitted that the decision was in Cuomo's hands. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. A man who said he believed a civil war was coming to America and was suspected of killing a right-wing protester in Portland, Oregon, died in a hail of police gunfire in neighboring Washington state. Police say Michael Reinold, 48, was armed with a semi-automatic handgun, but authorities have not determined if he fired any shots. In an interview with Vice News, Reinold said he had no choice but to do what he did because he thought he and a friend were about to be stabbed. He told Vice News he was an anti-fascist, but was not a member of Antifa, an umbrella description for far-left-leaning militant groups that resist neo-Nazis and white supremacists at demonstrations and other events. And as protests have become as ubiquitous in the United States as face masks and social distancing, Linda Perry has this report on what's been going down.
Thanks, Paul. There are a number of places where protests against racism and police brutality continue. In Atlantic City, a Black Lives Matter protest arose amid threats of vandalism and arrest, which ended in a peaceful joining together today of Atlantic City's mayor and a community activist who had threatened to paint those words, the words Black Lives Matter, on the Seaside Gambling Resort's historic boardwalk. Mayor Marty Small and protest organizer Steve Young picked up roller paint brushes and helped write those words on the pavement of MLK Jr. Boulevard in front of the city's Civil Rights Garden. Young wanted to paint the name of the movement on the boardwalk, which Small said is illegal. The mayor then planned the city's own event where the words could be painted in a public space. In other news, in Concord, New Hampshire, a lawmaker is being investigated over a Facebook post that advocated for burning and looting houses displaying Black Lives Matter signs. The state's attorney general sent a letter with a copy of the post by Republican Representative James Spillane to House Speaker Steve Shurtleff. Sean Locke of the Attorney General's office says that he has received complaints about the post and that members of the Black Lives Matter movement have expressed fears they might become targets of violence. And in Times Square, the NYPD says it's trying to find a car that drove through a group of Black Lives Matter protesters blocking a street in Times Square. Video posted on social media shows the car jerking through the crowd on Thursday night with its horn blaring as demonstrators scream and scramble out of the way. No one appeared to be seriously injured, but the NYPD said the car wasn't a police vehicle. They reported this on Twitter. And in Silver Springs, Maryland, for months, as nationwide protests against racial injustice and COVID-19 lockdown orders attracted all kinds of extremists using online platforms to plan, coordinate, and drum up support for their activities, Facebook and other tech companies have banned accounts linked to anti-government extremists. But the recent protests in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and elsewhere show how easy it can be for them to avoid digital roadblocks. Katie Paul with Tech Transparency Project says at least four private Facebook groups use their accounts to promote plans by supporters of the anti-government Boogaloo movement to attend the protests in Kenosha, this before the gunman shot and killed two protesters last week. Turning to Portland, it was once hailed as one of the most livable U.S. cities, but now Oregon's largest city is grappling with an uncertain future. This as it reaches a stunning benchmark of 100 consecutive nights of Black Lives Matter protests. In other news, the suffocation of a black man after police slipped a spit hood over his head has drawn new attention to the tactic and the frequent reliance on police to respond to mental health emergency. It underscores one of the top demands of the police reform movement that certain duties should not be handled by law enforcement, but by social workers or mental health experts. This while many in law enforcement defend the hoods as vital to prevent officers from being spit on or even bitten. Critics denounce these hoods as dangerous and inhumane. Daniel Prude was taken off life support a week after a hood was put over his head and he stopped breathing. Letitia James, the New York Attorney General, is investigating the police action in Rochester, New York, which was revealed on Wednesday through a video released by the family. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York. Back to you, Paul.
Thanks, Linda. And at this hour, activists with the New African Black Panther Party and a group of supporters calling themselves the Revolutionary Abolition Movement are protesting at 100 Center Street, the city jail known as the Tombs, demanding all charges be dropped against hundreds arrested in protests that began with the killing of George Floyd by police 3 months ago. The chairman of the New African Black Panther Party is Shaka Zulu.
The important reason that we're having a protest is because all across the country, since the advent of George Floyd's death, there have been spark of consciousness around the country, and young people are getting involved and struggle for the first time. The federal government is unleashing heavy-handed tactics against these young people. Subsequently, across the country, you see thousands of people arrested and incarcerated for peacefully protesting, and there are individuals in other pockets of the country being disappeared by special federal police mandated by the government to pluck activists off the street like they're animals or like they're plucking weeds out of a field. And so the New African Black Panther Party and our comrades from Revolutionary Abolition Movement decided that we need to make a call. We needed to stand in solidarity with all of the people who have been arrested and call for amnesty. We want the government of the United States to totally, completely drop all charges against these protesters. And we want the federal police to be rolled back. Our a primary call and secondary call is for the freedom of all people, especially our political prisoners. We want them released as they are victims of a huge injustice. So this is why we're making this call, to bring young people into the streets, to get them aware of their own power, to leverage their own power, to call for social justice. Now, the new African Black Panther Party wants the police to be totally and completely destroyed. As we see, they are the arm of the state. They are arm of the government, whose specific job is to control, isolate, and neutralize the black and oppressed communities.
And that's Shaka Zulu, chairman of the new African Black Panther Party. Saturday, another protest organized by the group Refuse Fascism is kicking off at 2 p.m. at Union Square Park. The demand is out now for the Trump-Pence regime, as the group calls it. A spokesperson is longtime revolutionary activist Carl Dix.
What's happening is tomorrow, September 5th, nationwide protest calling for Trump Pence out now. The protest in New York City is going to be at 2 p.m. at Union Square. There are going to be speakers from many of the different forces who have been out in the streets, not just in the recent protests against police terror, but going back to protests around the environment and attacks on immigrants. And we're coming together because the Trump-Pence regime is moving to hammer the final fascist nails into the coffin of democratic governance in this country. You can just look at what they've done in the past couple of weeks, calling forth white supremacist violence in places like Portland and Kenosha, and even backing up the vigilante in Kenosha who murdered two protesters and shot another. This is like a preview of what the sequel to Trump-Pence 1 will be, and it was horrific. This is them trying to enforce a different form of rule, one where people who organize to protest for Black Lives Mattering against the injustice that's coming down will be threatened with and even hit with roundups by state authorities, either officially or unofficially.
This is this play into the hands of Trump, who's trying to say that these protests are exactly what he should be reelected to put down?
No, it is not playing into those hands. And in fact, sitting back would play into their hands, because they are taking steps now to steal, subvert, and sabotage the elections, recruiting poll watchers, especially from among law enforcement and the military. And poll watchers in American history have always been aimed at intimidating black and brown people from voting. And look, this is important. It's so important that a revolutionary like me, who's never participated in a presidential election, is registering this time. I'm going to vote for Biden, not because I think Biden is any kind of friend of the people, but that him winning the election is part of the nonviolent tools that we have in our toolbox to stop this fascist regime from coming down. I am still stepping forward on the tune of making revolution and getting rid of this system. But right now, everybody, whether they're revolutionaries, environmentalists, Black Lives Matter activists, need to be in the streets saying Trump Pence out now. And Saturday, September 5th at 2 o'clock, that means being in Union Square and being part of launching 60 days of struggle to drive this regime out.
Carl Dix is a spokesperson for the group Refuse Fascism. And a group of activists hailing from Portland, Oregon, and other politically savvy parts of the country have come up with a guide to help activists organize their own protests called 40 Ways to Fight Fascist Street Legal Tactics for Community Activists. It's written by Spencer Sunshine, who spoke with WBAI.
It originally came out directly after Charlottesville, where we felt like the 2017 protest and counter-protest in Charlottesville, where we felt like not enough people were doing work to help neutralize and contain the far right and fascists. This is basically a step-by-step guide about what people can do when dealing with white nationalist groups and with violent far-right groups. People continued to circulate it. The original edition had some problems. Portland has been the center of a lot of this activity for the last few years. Pop Mob in Portland was distributing it, so we talked about revamping it and redesigning it and reissuing it. So it's been in the works for quite a while, the new edition. It was odd to come out right at this moment, but I think people are hungry to have something to do. People who are not directly involved already are hungry to have some practical things to be.
Why do this? Why now? And what's in it?
There's obviously a resurgence in far-right activism right now. And what's in it is 40 practical steps that everyday people that are available to people of most backgrounds and skill levels can take to help neutralize and contain far-right and fascist groups. They include things about how to get started doing this, how to watch these activists, specific tactics you can do, like pushing public groups to oppose the far-right, like making it more difficult for them to meet, driving wedges between them, finding people to work with, how to do publicity and educational work, how to try to win media strategies, how to build organization on your side, what to do with demonstrations, like some of the nuts and bolts of that, and then ways that you can be supportive. There's a lot of support work that needs to be done that I think is really work available to a lot of different people who don't normally do activist stuff, like when people are injured or get in trouble with the law, or God forbid, sometimes people are killed and their families need help. So there's a whole range of different things that people can do. And this is a step-by-step guide to introduce people to how think about the different things they could do and tell them how to do it.
Where can people get this book?
The printable PDFs and the text are available online at SpencerSunshine.com/40ways, FORTYWAYS.
Spencer Sunshine is an activist working to counter the far right. And the death of Daniel Prude at the hands of police has led to a debate about how cops should respond to calls involving emotionally disturbed persons. Among the cause of death mentioned by the government in Prude's death was complications of asphyxia in the setting of physical restraint. But also added was the phrase that the death was caused by excited delirium due to intoxication by the drug PCP. But Melissa Moore of the Drug Policy Alliance says in a statement, "Make no mistake, PCP intoxication and excited delirium did not kill Daniel Prude. Police violence killed Daniel Prude." Melissa Moore spoke with WBAI.
The most important thing to remember is that his death was officially ruled a homicide due to asphyxiation, due to the actions and the violence perpetrated at the hands of law enforcement. And it's absolutely absurd that the autopsy even lists quote-unquote excited delirium, which is, you know, it's a condition that's not even recognized by numerous health organizations in PCP intoxication. Those are completely beside the point. It's reflective of a larger pattern where we see law enforcement attempting to blame people who are either in the midst of a mental health crisis or allegedly under the influence of some substance for their own death, which has happened at the hands of police. We can all be very clear that supposed substances or a mental health issue did not kill Danny Prude. That was caused by police violence that killed him.
What does this tell you about our relationship to the idea of drugs, which millions of Americans take, like it or not?
It points to, first and foremost, the extreme stigma and misinformation surrounding drugs. I mean, the entire narrative around your super strength with stimulants like crack, it reinforces incredibly problematic narratives and is used to justify abhorrent behavior towards people. It's not rooted in fact, it's not rooted in people's actual experience. And so I think, you know, first and foremost, we need to get away from the kind of like sensationalized narratives around drugs and go back to what you were saying, which is that a lot of people use a really wide variety of substances in our state and in our country, and we would do much better to take more of a harm reduction approach that's actually rooted in science and rooted in evidence about how the body reacts to different substances, but moreover, meets people where they're at and makes sure that they're going to be able to be safe and that their well-being is centered within every conversation and every interaction that we're having, which was clearly not the case here.
Right. And of course, marijuana, at one point, we had plenty of films. We look at them and laugh nowadays. But marijuana was said to cause sexual licentiousness, violence, insanity of all different sorts. Totally made up, had nothing to do with the real experience.
What we know more than anything in this country is, around our drug policy, is that it doesn't have to do with the actual substance, with the pharmacology, but rather to do with the face of who's perceived to be the dominant user or who's perceived to be a threat in whatever situation, and that's weaponized really consistently, as opposed to actually basing our policies on science and fact.
Who should respond when somebody does have a panic attack?
This is a case in point of why when we're dealing with a health issue, we should have a health entity provide the response so that we're making sure that the steps taken and the care provided to the individual who needs it in that moment is actually care and is actually going to be beneficial and supportive to them and not end their life. And I think we see this over and over again, that police are not the entities that are equipped to deal with the vast majority of scenarios that they're involved with at this point.
Whatever happened to marijuana legalization in New York?
There's still a vibrant movement for marijuana justice in New York, and that includes legalization and addressing the harms of prior criminalization and the ways in which marijuana criminalization and enforcement has been used as a justification or as a pretext by law enforcement to target communities and individuals.
But are we going to get it before this governor leaves office? This pandemic seems to put everything else on hold. Are people talking about it now?
New Jersey has a ballot initiative this fall. There's been some movement in Connecticut as well. And Pennsylvania's governor also made some statements recently about legalization and also tying it to community reinvestment.
And as Melissa Moore, as legal marijuana has become a multi-billion dollar business, POTS Roots as a small business, people-friendly endeavor is changing. High Times Magazine, where I was once editor-in-chief, has come under intense criticism for becoming a corporate debt-loaded establishment entity at odds with its founding as a mouthpiece for the cannabis movement. Melissa Moore adds that unless care is taken, pot will slip through the people's hands.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting case study and points to, you know, one of the structural factors that we've been looking at throughout our campaign, which is that, you know, we can legalize marijuana for adult use, and we can establish, you know, things like social equity program and incubator, as well as community reinvestment. But we're not operating in a vacuum, right? Like, this is still, a market capitalist economy, and, you know, legalizing marijuana doesn't change that. That's why we've been really clear with our campaign of forefronting policies and a framework that is going to specifically have small license opportunities, centering small farmers, is looking at cooperatives and things of that nature, that really centering the needs of the smallest players in the space and recognizing that the larger players are well positioned as it is, but really looking in New York in particular about how we can make sure that there are avenues for entry to the marketplace and opportunities that are really geared toward some of the smaller players and transitioning folks from the illicit market as well, and making sure that there are those on-ramps for people. That's really what's going to make the legalization effort in New York successful.
Melissa Moore is the New York State Director of the Drug Policy Alliance. And we're going to put off. We had a story from Peter Kornbluh and from folks on the scene in Chile about the 50th anniversary of the Allende regime, which was overthrown in a violent coup sponsored by the Nixon administration and his national security advisor at the time, Henry Kissinger. Next week, September 11th, will be the September 11th is a pretty big day, right, in American history and in Chilean history as well, and links the day throughout the all of the Western Hemisphere. I'm sure we'll be talking about that next week. But we have to, here at WBAI, take a moment to ask for your support. Our number, by the way, is 516.